Okay. This week is Parshat Bishalach, which of course is chock full of amazing things. Obviously, the highlight is Shirat Hayam and Kriyat Yamsuf. We've talked about that in the past. It ends with Melchemet Amalek, which is its own starring piece. It also has, of course, the very critical story of the Man, which is sort of the centerpiece of the Parshat, the centerpiece of the whole travelogue between Mitzrayim and Sinai. With all the things that we've talked about, I want to talk about one often overlooked detail, which is at the very beginning of Parshat Bishalach, and I believe it helps kind of inform a lot more of the career of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Parshat begins, "Vayhi Bishalach Parotam v'lo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim ki karovu." Parenthetically, Rav Yoel Ben-Nun has a illuminating article about what Hashem's concern here was, and not having Bnei Yisrael go on the Via Maris, on the coast road, ki karovu, ki amar Elohim pen yinachem ha'am birotam milchama v'shavu mitzrayimah, that they might get scared when they see war, and they're going to come back to Mitzrayim. So instead, v'yasev Elohim ata'am derech ha'midbar yam suf, v'chamushim alu Bnei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. Right, so Hashem turned them. Parenthetically, there's a midrash that this is a midrash, a source for Hasebat the Seder, but he turned them to go in towards the desert, in other words, south, towards Yam Suf, and they all left Chamushim, which simple read of that means that they were armed in some sense. Now, this pasuk is out of order, as you can see. Vayikach Moshe et atzmot Yosef imo. Why is that out of order? Because Bnei Israel are already traveling. They're already moving instinctively, perhaps, towards the north and hit the coast road and then go up to Canaan. And instead, Hashem turns them. How does Hashem turn them? We're going to hear that a little later on in the Parsha. There's a cloud that's leading them, and the cloud leads them instead south and due east to go towards Yam Suf. And then we find that Moshe took Atzmot Yosef with him, which means that when Moshe left the capital, he went and disinterred the bones of Yosef that were in some sort of a sarcophagus, and he took them with him, which seems to mean that this is something that happened earlier, before they actually left the town. Now, what's the reason that Moshe takes the bones? Because Yosef had made Bnei Yisrael, literally Bnei Yisrael, his brothers, take an oath, which was, Pakod yifkor Elohim etchem, we're going to come back to that, God will indeed remember you, which means your life here in Egypt, as cushy and as pleasant as it is right now, Yosef saying to his brothers, is not where you're supposed to be. God will remember you and bring you back. And when he brings you back, take my bones with you when you go. Right? And we've talked in the past about Yosef's job was to bring them back to Israel. Therefore, he had to wait in Mitzrayim until they went. But the question I want to ask is two things. Why is Moshe the one charged with this? Why doesn't Moshe hand this off to somebody else? I mean, Moshe's leading the whole nation. Why doesn't he direct one of Aaron's sons, or why doesn't he direct, there's no kahuna yet, why doesn't he direct some member of another tribe and honor them? You get the honor of taking Yosef's bones. Why doesn't he tell Yoshua to do this? After all, Yoshua is a direct descendant of Yosef. Why does he do it himself? The second question I want to ask is, why is it placed out of order? Why is it mentioned here? Why isn't it mentioned at the beginning of this passage, or perhaps back in Parshat Bo, when it talks about Bnei Israel leaving their place to go to Sukkot from Ramses? All right, so we're going to come back to that. And they leave Sukkot, and they go to Etam, which is the edge of the desert. Now, important note, just as a parenthetic thing, they left Ramses. Ramses, which was one of their settlements in Mitzrayim, and they immediately moved. This is on the 15th in the morning. They moved to Sukkot. Sukkot is not an Egyptian name. Sukkot is a Canaanite word. We know a place called Sukkot in the Jordan, which is Yaakov's Sukkot. Right? So it sounds as if there is some sort of a Canaanite settlement, or perhaps even an Israelite settlement, on the outskirts of Egypt, moving east, which has remained there, and that's where Bnei Israel camp. Either that, or they camped at some empty place and built Sukkot, and they called it Sukkot or because of the clouds. But it sounds like there was a place already called Sukkot there, just as a parenthetic note. But again, the question is, why is Moshe the one carrying out Tzvot Yosef, and why is it mentioned here out of order? All right, so let's look at that source for where Yosef issues this oath. This is at the very end of Bereshit. So Yosef's on his deathbed. He says, I am dying. There we go. Notice what he says. God will remember you, and God will bring you up out of this land. Notice how it's quoted in Shmot. Pakod yifkor Elohim etchem, v'ha'alitem et atzmotai mizeh etchem. You bring my bones up from here. Which, of course, is what Yosef says in the next line. What it leaves out is, Pakod yifkor Elohim etchem, v'alatchem min ha'aretz hazot. God will remember you and bring you out of the land. Instead, the pasuk conflates them. God will remember you, and look at the next line of what Yosef says. V'ashpah Yosef b'nei Yisrael emor, Pakod yifkor Elohim etchem, v'alitem et atzmotai mizeh. Now, that indeed is the oath, and that's what the text is quoting. But the text left out the passage about taking us out, which, of course, is in the middle of happening now, so perhaps there's no need to mention it. So if you take a look just at the two lines in Bereshit, you could see an interesting correlation. Is God will remember you and will bring you up out of this land. And then the oath is God will remember you, the same phrase, Pakod yifkor Elohim etchem, and then you will bring my bones up. Interesting conflation, and we'll come back to it. Now, we roll back to Yaakov going down to Mitzrayim. And a few weeks ago, I spoke about Beersheba and why Beersheba is consistently translated in the Septuagint nearly every time, not as Beersebe, but rather as the well of the oath, Freyati de Orku, right? The well of the oath. Because the oath, and I contended that the oath that's so significant in Beersheba is not the oath that Avram took with Avimelech, or that Yitzchak did with Avimelech, but rather the oath that Hashem gave to Yaakov when he left Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan, and he said to him, Anochi ered imcha Mitzrayim, among other things, Vanochi alcha gamalo, I will go down with you to Mitzrayim, and I will also bring you up. Okay? Now, notice what happens when Hashem speaks to Moshe the first time. At the snap, he says, after all of the introductory pieces and take off your shoes, etc., and Moshe refusing to look, says, Ra'o ra'iti et oni ami asher Mitzrayim. Source 4, that sa'akatam shamati b'nei noksav ki yadati et machovav. I have heard their crying because they're in pain. Va'ered lahatzilo. I am coming down to bring them, to save them. U'laha'aloto min ha'aretz, to save them from Egypt and to bring them up. Exactly the same words that Hashem used in the context of his promise to Yaakov, I'm going to go down with you and bring you back up. Okay, so at this point, we've got to sort of ask, what is happening here? And what it seems as if that Yosef's bones in this picture seem to be sort of a miniature model of Am Yisrael. Yosef's bones, not only Yosef came down to Mitzrayim, he was thrown into a pit. He ended up in Mitzrayim, thrown into a pit there, into the prison. And then ultimately his bones were put somewhere. And now we're bringing his bones up. And as you see in Bereshit at the end, in Source 2, that's sort of a model for bringing Am Yisrael up. But notice that when Hashem speaks to Moshe, he uses the same phraseology used with Yaakov. I am going down and I'm bringing you up. And now, instead of it being the person Yaakov, it's the people Yaakov, the people of Israel. Keep that in mind. We're still not there. Something, and this is really what caught my attention, the first thing that caught my attention about this whole topic, is that Moshe, when he runs away to Midian, and he meets Zipporah, meets Reuel, and he marries Reuel's daughter, Zipporah, and they have a kid. Vayikra et shmo Gershom. Not Gershon, which would be a realistic, a meaningful name because it's a name in the Levi family, Gershon. Instead, he gives him a name that we haven't heard before, which is Gershom, and he explains what it means. Ger hayiti be'eretz nochriya, meaning I am a Gershom. I'm a ger, a stranger, a visitor there. Which means, by the way, interesting thing is that wherever Moshe is, he feels like he's not at home. He's referring to his home as there, away, not here. And it's ger shom, I'm a ger be'eretz nochriya. Okay? Now, one other piece to this puzzle about Moshe's young life happens just before that. Remember, that's the episode that happens when Moshe runs away after killing the Mitzri and after finding out that other Jews know about it and that Paro knows about it. Paro wants to kill him. He runs away, comes and saves the daughters, etc., and ends up marrying Tzipporah and then having the kid. Earlier, that whole scene starts with this. That series of scenes starts with this. This is after Moshe is raised in the palace. He grows up. He goes out to his brothers. Vayar besiv lotam, and he sees their pain. Vayar ish mitzri make ish ivri me'achav. What does he see? He sees an Egyptian striking one of his brethren Hebrews. What does he do? Vayifen kovacho vayar ki ein ish. He looks around, and he sees that there's nobody there. What does he do? He strikes the Egyptian and he buries him. Now, the word vayachet ha-mitzri is an odd word. He strikes the Egyptian. What should it say? It should say vayaharoget ha-mitzri. He kills him. In other words, what's Moshe's intent here? Is Moshe intending to strike the guy or to kill the guy? He's looking around in all directions because he wants to be safe. He's not going to be safe if he only strikes the guy and the guy lives. So he's clearly intending to kill him. So why doesn't it say Vayarogat Amitzri? Because what the text is doing is saying this is an appropriate punishment. Because what was the Mitzri doing to the Ivri? Yake make ishivi me'achav. The Egyptian was striking him, so Moshe struck him. Of course, Moshe striking him was a little different, was with the intent of killing him. But there's something else going on in Moshe's Vayachet HaMitzri. And this is something that was brought to my attention by actually one of Rabbi Lamb's sermons that are now being published. And he quoted Yisrael Eldad, who in his Yigaron Mikra makes this point almost as an aside. But I think it's a very valuable point. Let's take a look here. And this is where it's all going to start. Perhaps the most catalyzing and the most foundational nevuah that exists in Breshit is Brit Ben Abtarim. When Hashem speaks to Avram and tells him essentially what the history of his children is going to look like, either as a one-time cycle of events or else as an ongoing cycle of events, which is as follows. Vayomer Avram, Yadoa teda ki ger yeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem va'avadum v'inu otam arba miot shana. We all know this phrase. Hashem says to Avram, you should know that your children are going to be strangers in a foreign land, and they're going to be oppressed for a very long time. I will judge the nation that oppresses them, and then they'll live with great wealth. Okay, this is a promise given to Avram. So now I'm going to ask a very large theological question. When God makes a promise about how things are going to play out, and a promise of what he's going to do in response. What is our responsibility towards that promise? And I think it's safe to say that most people would answer nothing. Our responsibility is, if possible, to see it happening, recognize it, give thanks for it, and when the door opens, go through the door and leave, but not to have anything to do with activating it. Yet, I'm not sure that that was the way Moshe Rabbeinu saw things. Notice what happens. The promise given to Avram that we're going to arguendo, claim that Moshe was aware of, and I think it's good basis for that. Ki ger yeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. Your children will be strangers in a foreign land. What does Moshe call his son? Ger shom. Almost as if Moshe is saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, see, it's happened already. We're strangers in a foreign land. And he even refers to where he's living as Sham, not Po, not Khan, but Ger Sham. The next thing that happens is, although it happened earlier, but the next thing that we looked at is Moshe goes out to see how his brethren are doing, and he sees an Ivri being struck, which means that this part of the pasuk has been fulfilled. They are being enslaved and oppressed. What does Moshe do to the Mitzri? He doesn't report him. He doesn't demote him. He kills him. And the word used is bayah. Please take a look at what Please look at what Hashem promises he's going to do to the nation that oppresses. He's going to judge them, which of course happens through what series of events? The Eser Makot, of which some of them, by the way, do use the word Vayach, that I'm going to smite you with Dever, etc., right? With Barad. So it's as if Moshe is trying to activate the divine promise and speed it along. It's something that we might refer to as sort of messianic activism, right? Messianic activism. In other words, it's not just that I'm waiting and anticipating redemption. I'm going to act in a way that's going to, if you will, push God towards that action, something that in a more technical term we refer to as theurgy. Theurgy is doing human actions which sort of motivate or push or get the wheel going for divine action and response. Now, I know that sounds foreign, it sounds crazy, and yet there's a Mishnah that says exactly that. You know which Mishnah I'm referring to, of course? The Mishnah in Masechet Tanit that tells the story about Choni HaMa'agil. What happened that year when there was no rain? And unclear when Choni lived, and Machlok at Bavli Yerushalmi when he lived. But whatever it is, what happened the year that it didn't rain? That year they came to Choni, what they asked him to do? You pray, meaning what was their first approach? You know how to appeal to God to get him to make it rain, which means already we're talking about theurgy, meaning you're going to pray and your prayers are going to effectuate a change. He takes it much further. What does he end up doing? He ends up not only pleading with God, he ends up demanding of God in a way that Shimon ben Shetach says to him, if you weren't Choni, I'd throw you in Cherem. How dare you speak to God that way? Which is, I'm drawing a circle. I'm not leaving the circle till it rains. And then when there's a few drops, he says, I don't mean that. And then when it comes storming, he says, I don't mean that. I mean Gishmei Bracha, until there's finally good Geshem, and then he walks out. Which means that on the one hand, his behavior was seen by the Beit Din as inappropriate, but not inappropriate because it doesn't work. Inappropriate because it's chutzpah de klape shamayim, but it seems to work. So I'd like to suggest, perhaps, just as a proposal, that that's what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing here. Moshe Rabbeinu is naming his kid Gershom because he's trying to activate Ger Yezar Achem, Ber Solahem. Ger Yezar Achem, Ber Solahem. And he strikes the Mitzri, and it's described as Vayach, even though he kills him, to implicate both the Midah Kenegah Midah, what the Egyptian was doing to the Hebrew, Makeh, also to pre-anticipate, as it were, foreshadow the makot, that Moshe Rabbeinu is kind of starting that whole process of striking the Egyptians, and also to activate the gam etavoy asher yavodu dan anochi, that Hashem is going to judge them. And we're going to see more of this now. Wild thing. When we first meet Yaakov in Mitzrayim, meaning at the end of his life, at the beginning of Vayechi, Yaakov thinks he's on his deathbed. It's not so clear that it isn't on his deathbed, but he summons Yosef alone, and he makes Yosef take an oath, a very famous oath with his hand on the thigh, take an oath that he will not bury him in Mitzrayim, rather he will take him to Canaan and bury him in Hebron in the field that was bought by Abraham. The end of that phrase is a little strange. It ends with Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh Hamita, that Yisrael, Ben Yaakov, bowed at the top of the bed. It's a very strange phrase. And the Midrashim try to play with it and soften it and come with something else. However, if you look in the Septuagint, you will find that the description of what Yaakov did is a little different. It says, Prakai prosekinesen Yisrael epiton akron, on the top, Tesrabdu autu. He bowed on the top of his staff. In other words, how are they reading the word al-rosh ha? Not mita, but mate. Now, that's a very strange thing. And alone, we would say somebody was, you know, asleep at the switch when they're translating it. The only problem is that the Pshita, the famous Syriac translation, is a Jewish translation of Tanakh, has the same thing, right? And there's, you have the English translation, he bowed on top of his staff. Not only that, and I'm not happy bringing this as an aid, but we got three aidim now, is in one of the Pauline epistles, he has the same description, although mixes it up between the stories, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. But the point is that there was a tradition that when Yaakov referred to as being brought back to Israel, he uses the staff as a focal point for recognizing that. And of course, what is plays a central role in the whole Mosaic agency is the matet. It starts at the set, at the snat. And Hashem says, take the matet with you when you go, right? So now I'd like to roll back to the beginning and then bring something towards at the end about this entire piece. Because we started by asking two questions. Why is Yosef the one to carry Yosef's bones with him? And why is it mentioned out of order? So I'd like to pose that the two actually go together. Moshe is the one to take Yatzmat Yosef because Moshe is the one to be in charge of being the lightning rod, if you will, for Geula. He is the one who, because of his own initiative in striking the Egyptian and naming his child Gershom, Hashem then says to him, you're the man who is going to activate the Geula. And now, when we roll back to Bereishit, we see in those two passages in source two that Yosef's bones being brought up is emblematic of Am Yisrael being brought up. So by Moshe being the one to be entrusted with Yosef's bones, it is emblematic of, and it's sort of a miniature version of taking Am Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Moshe taking Yosef's bones out is Moshe actively activating the Geula by taking them. And we find, of course, famously, that that in the tefillah, we mentioned, of course, Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, Elohei Yitzchak, Gemel Chasdim Tovim Kone Hakol, Zocher Chasdei Avot Umevi Goel Livnei Vneihem. In other words, we tie in the Goel, which seems to be Moshe primarily. You bring a Goel to their descendants, the descendants of the Avot, as tied in with the Chasdei Avot, which means that all these things happening about the promises given to Abraham, the way that Yaakov was sworn in Beersheba, the way that Yaakov bowed towards his staff. These are all things that then become activated in the Goel Livnei Vneihem. So I want to bring this together at the end with a very famous midrash, which becomes challenging for those of us who teach Tanakh and who really endeavor to instill good textual skills and analytic thinking in our students when studying Tanakh. You know, we're accustomed, unfortunately, to thinking that analytic skills and rigorous thinking is reserved for Gemara, and more, shall we say, experiential and spiritual kind of feeling is associated with the study of Tanakh. And as Lichtenstein Zatzal used to say, you have to actually use both for both. You have to bring the exciting, creative, and spiritual experience to your study of Gemara, and you have to bring the analytic skills and the rigorous thinking to your study of Tanakh as well. And so we take a look at, and so that's why I say it's part of the challenge of those of us who teach Tanakh and endeavor to instill rigorous thinking and skills, is we often have to separate our students from when, especially when they're, let's say, in middle school and high school, to separate them from the Midrashim with which they grew up, not to separate them fully, but to give them a different perspective on it, to understand, here's what the text says, here are Midrashim, here are the difficulties of the text, here's how Mefarshim deal with it. In some cases, the Midrashim can help. In some cases, they don't speak to issues of exegetical difficulties, but rather to try to glean new lessons. I bring that up because one of the most popular Midrashim that students are scandalized to find is not there explicit in the Chumash is Bat Paro's arm. Everybody loves Bat Paro's arm. What's the pasuk? Vatera Bat Paro lechotz al ha'or. This is now rolling further back in Moshe's career to when Moshe is a newborn, so 3 months old. Bat Paro goes to bathe. V'naratel lechotz al yad ha'or. Her maidens go with her. Vatera tateva betoch hasuf. She sees the basket sitting there in the marshes. It's not floating anywhere, by the way. Vatishlachet amata vatikachah. Literally, she takes her, sends her maidservant. The maidservant goes and brings it. Rashi on the spot says, "Et amata et shifchata." By the way, nobody remembers that part of the Rashi. They remember this: Rabbeinu drashu lashon yad. He quotes the midrash. It's a midrash in Masachat Sota, right? That amata might mean is machloket might mean her hand, like your ama. Avalafi dikduk lashon hakodesh hayal v'naked amata. He said, but if that was accurate, then there should be a dagesh in the mem, because the word ama as a maidservant is written without a dagesh in the mem. The word ama as your arm, your forearm, is written with a dagesh, and it's written without a dagesh, right? So that's his point. Mem degusha. Now, vehem darshu, but then he says, but the drasha, which Rashi says, not pshat, what's the drasha? Et amata, et yada, Nishtar beva amata amot harbe. That her hand stretched out many amot, her ama, which we use as a measurement, stretched out many amot and gathered Moshe in. We have this arm extending very far and bringing it in. It's an image that we've all grown up with. Stop shot. What's the point of the midrash? Now, sometimes you could say the point of the midrash is to teach a lesson. Point of the midrash is to give us another angle on the personality of the people involved. What's the point of this midrash? So I'd like to suggest, based on the following comment of Sforno, that here's what's going on in the Midrash. We have, of course, a great difficulty with the name Moshe. Because who names the baby Moshe? Not his parents. Evidently, although there is a chizkuni different, evidently he's named by Bat Paro. The difficulty is, how does Bat Paro know Hebrew? Right. Okay. So the Sforno says the following. Hatam Shekrativ Moshe. So the Sforno assumes that she knows Hebrew, or she says he's a Hebrew boy. I'll ask somebody who knows Hebrew what to name him. Lahorot Shimalet Tacherimhu. Important to note, I called him Moshe not because I pulled him out, because then his name would be Nimshe or Mashui, but rather he will be someone who pulls others out. Moshe means someone who draws others out of the water, not somebody drawn out of the water. Ki omnam mishitiyu minamayim achashay mutav etocham. After all, I pulled him out of the water when he was there. V'zeh lo haya ki'im b'gzerat irin. This must have been God's decree. Kedei shi'imaleitu et acherim. So that he will pull others out. In other words, the Sforno is saying that what Bat Paro recognizes here is that the miraculous salvation of Moshe through her agency foreshadows a greater salvation that he will be the key person for. He was saved so he can save others. He was saved out of the water so he can pull others out of the depths of Mitzrayim. Moshe, not Mashui, the one who pulls others out. Okay, so if that's the case, and we look at the whole story of Moshe being put in the water and being saved miraculously by Paro as foreshadowing Yetziat Mitzrayim, what is the very famous phrase that is used consistently to describe Yetziat Mitzrayim, even though it's not used in the context of any other salvation? In Tanakh, that Hashem took us out b'yad chazakah uvizroa netuyah, with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And although the outstretched arm motif is a clearly Egyptian motif, and take a look at Dr. Josh Berman's Anima Amin to see some great stuff about that, there's also something else going on here, which is Hashem took us out with a strong arm, with an outstretched arm, and therefore we have Bat Paro having an outstretched arm to pull Moshe in to foreshadow that Geula. But for our purposes, what that also does is it immediately, at 3 months, turns Moshe Rabbeinu into the lightning rod for Geula, the one that attracts the attention and then gives that attention out, that theurgy out, that generates the movement to get the ball rolling for Geulat Am Yisrael, of which, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu is the ultimate shaliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make that happen.
Sorry about the phone call.
All good.